America is less prepared for emotional, physical, mental, spiritual crises than ever before in our national history. Yet today, happening almost at the same time, the spectacle of human nature in full sway in massive hoarding, the collection of dry goods, canned goods, the run on big home freezers, on wood-burning stoves, and any other means to stave off what appears to be an impending crisis of national proportions. Yet, these crises seem to be coming upon us apace. Global crises of dwindling natural resources, an energy crisis of perhaps unprecedented proportions. The point is, no one seems to know where we go from here. How will it be solved? Is it only a temporary energy crisis that will soon be behind us because we'll all get our shoulders to the wheel and manage to save so many hundreds or billions of kilowatt hours that we'll have plenty of electricity to spare in 1976, 79, or 82? Or is it something with which we all shall have to live and which will require massive readjustments in our entire daily way of life? After World War II, the United States gradually eased into an era of what I call the play ethic. Today, as never before, huge sports spectacles, a tremendous attention to professional sports where athletes are paid up into the millions of dollars, as is popularly known, for simply stuffing a round ball wrapped in cowskin through an iron hoop with string hanging on it, or beating a baseball across a cow pasture, if you want to talk in the vernacular, running a football up and down artificial turf and complaining about broken knees and sprained ankles. And not that this necessarily is bad, I like to watch it too, but Americans more and more taking their sport sitting down. It is merely an overview, an overstatement, I think, and not an overstatement, but an overall statement of the fact that America has entered an era of play. Boat shows, home shows, huge displays of all sorts of equipment such as dune buggies and motorcycles and all kinds of conveyances to carry our bodies to the sand dunes, the seashore. Let's see, they've got the surf Porsche, the sun Porsche, and the snow Porsche, all of which are just the same car with a different color on it. And the idea is get out, enjoy life, take what you can while you may, and may the devil take the hindmost in our search for pleasure. An avalanche of sporting equipment and goods. The average affluent, middle-class American home, you can look in the garage, and what are you going to find? Skis, fishing equipment, hunting equipment, maybe tucked away somewhere else in the house. All kinds of clothing for different types of sports. A set or two or three of golf clubs and the like. Well, somehow, all of this seems to get more and more irrelevant as we begin to think about sharp curtailment of air travel, of the trucking industry, a close down in the city-sponsored bus lines just when we were beginning to get to the point where some big cities were building subways, as in Oakland, where some big cities were getting into rapid transit like the Bay Area BART system, so highly publicized, maybe a couple of years late, up in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, where extensive advertising urged people to take the RTD, and now we find these same systems threatened with cancellation or sharp curtailment of service just as they're beginning to get put into service in the first place. Then one begins to wonder, as America reeled around the dizzying 60s of our massive strikes, our huge disruptions of at least 68 American cities, where at one time there were more American National Guardsmen with fixed bayonets confronting American citizens in riot-torn cities with buildings in flames than there were American troops on the battlefields in Vietnam. As we reach that absolute shuddering apex of our play ethic, of frantically searching for pleasure wherever it may be found, suddenly some of these voices, not heeded at all, paid little attention to, almost unrecognized, unrealized, in the midst of all the din and the clamor for getting out and away from it all, began to finally come crushing in on us. Devaluation of the dollar, American economy in trouble abroad, opening shots of global trade war, terrifying consequences eventually, the imbalance of American trade, the balance of payments deficits, monetary crises around the world, shuddering impacts to the stock market, then the growing disenchantment, with the American public and its leadership. The disenchantment with American leadership, by the way, Watergate, the resignation of the Vice President of the United States, was a bigger shock to the United States abroad. The effect upon our allies in Europe, in Japan, and other parts of the world was a bigger effect than the entirety of 10 years in Vietnam. The Gary Powers U-2 spy incident, the Pueblo incident, the Bay of Pigs disaster, almost anything you want to mention in the decades that preceded it. Little do we realize what a tremendous shuddering shock this loss of confidence was abroad and what its eventual consequences are going to be. But now here we are in the opening throes of not just an energy crisis, but an energy shortage, where we're going to begin experiencing shortages of many crucial materials. Now, last time, I talked about the fact that it's an actual shortage, not just in cutbacks due to Arabian policies toward the United States, as a result of their irritation over our Middle Eastern policy, vis-a-vis the support of Israel, but a shortage of global proportions. A list of what we really are short of today is staggering, and I intend to give you that list in the next program or two as we go systematically through what is happening right now in the energy shortages that we are finding around us. I said last time that exploding populations, increasing demand, the voracious gobbling up of Earth's resources by ever-expanding industrial giants such as Japan, Western Europe, and the United States are voracious beyond belief in the toll they are taking of non-renewable energy resources. And finally, we're going to have to pay the piper. People talked about 50 years with regard to coal, maybe 10 years or less with regard to natural gas. That's the ultimate limits upon which they place the reserves, the known reserves of some of these energy sources. But people continually seem to feel science has always rescued us in the past. Certainly it's going to do it this time. That at the last moment, just prior to disaster, we will snatch victory out of what appears to be defeat, because we'll convert to solar energy, or we'll go to nuclear energy. We will find new and different energy sources. Well, last time I talked of how, first of all, and most noticeable, it began to interfere with American pursuit of pleasure. One of these days, I suppose, we'll find out the NFL Sunday night games will be canceled, or Monday night, rather, because the team couldn't arrive because of a canceled flight, who knows, or because the stadiums are about half empty, because people simply didn't have the gasoline to get there. Be that as it may, the really big crunch is in the trucking industry, the airlines, in private business and manufacturing concerns, and to go on with that, there is an entire host of products very few people know about that have been interrupted as a result even of the Arab oil cutbacks. And those have to do with the petrochemical industries, the coal tar derivatives, some of the manufactured refined products that came from Holland and other countries who took Arab crude, made it into some of these chemicals and other products that we use, and they too have been virtually cut to nothing, boycotted. And so you see, coal tar derivatives, crude oil, petrochemical products, such as plastics, vinyls, finishes, synthetics, and the like, becoming an increasingly short supply. And I read one article that already the automotive industry is hard hit as a result of vinyl coming in increasing short supply, meaning vinyl for the tops of automobiles and the seat coverings that are commonly used. It ranges perhaps all the way from linoleum to flooring and roofing material, building material, synthetic fabrics, automobile rooftops and seats, as I said, and all this directly related to cutbacks in oil, dwindling reserves of coal in the face of increased demands by steam-producing energy sources for electricity. And I remind you, as I did on a program on pollution, that as we have built some of these huge steam-producing electric plants out in the Western Desert, I think at least two of them in the Four Corners region, I showed you on a chart or a graph in a previous program, I think last season one time, I remember, that it took exactly 200 of the large American size coal cars every single day just to fuel the furnaces of one of these big electricity-producing plants. Well, prior to this time, we had some coal restrictions because of the high sulfur content of certain softer coals. And now that has all been lifted, so we're going to see increased pollution. It shows you how quickly our, and it's a funny thing I'll talk about for a minute, how quickly our priorities change. In order to keep our toys, our hugely overpowered automobiles with giant engines that roar and make lots of noise but have a terrible power-to-weight ratio and don't go anywhere oftentimes, the application of smog devices, which consumes up to a time and a half or double the amount of gasoline we used to consume to get to the same exact destination, built-in two-year obsolescence, thin, almost paper-thin tinfoil-like structure of the body itself, equipment that doesn't work in our automobiles, but in order to hang on to these toys of ours, here's what we're looking at. Our toys take us to the places in pursuit of the good life. We want the good life. We want to escape the city in our toys, our Sun Porsche or our Snow Porsche, and get out to the mountains or the beach where it's at. But in order to do this, to get to where there is clean air, we're willing, in order to keep our toys, to dirty and foul and pollute our environment more and more and more so that we don't have to experience any fears that there will come stringent cutbacks in automobile manufacturing, that there will be fewer and fewer automobiles available and less fuel to run them. No, we would rather say no holds barred, all stops pulled out, go to any limits imaginable, strip the Rockies with strip mines and shale oil, open up all of the military reserves left into the ground in terms of one of the vast naval drilling fields in the Bakersfield area, Long Beach area, East Texas field, up in Montana and Wyoming areas, up in the Brooks Range in Alaska, go ahead and build the pipeline. Before this time, we had conservationist groups, all sorts of ecosphere-conscious people lobbying in Washington. Don't build the pipeline because it'll interfere with migratory paths and patterns of caribou and wildlife and so on. All of that's out the window. An overwhelming, tremendous majority vote to run that pipeline through in a hurry if it threatens to take away from us some of our modern playthings that we just don't want to give up. Well, the time is going to come where, like it or not, we are going to have forced upon us some decisions I'm going to tell you about that we should have made years and years ago.
While people struggle through the Depression, the Plain Truth magazine was warning about European nationalism. When everyone sighed relief at the end of World War II, the Plain Truth was predicting the Middle East crisis. When Korea dominated the headlines, the Plain Truth was forecasting the formation of the common market. When the space race captured America's fancy, the Plain Truth was covering trade war and the rise of Japan, future super giant. To keep ahead of today's world trends, send for your free subscription. Write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. The Plain Truth Magazine, after 38 years, still ahead of its time.
You probably remember back to the very first automobile you ever owned. I think one subject very close to the American heart is the automobile. It's got to be because we are the users of about half of the entire world's supply, and in the Los Angeles area, on a per capita basis, I believe there's the heaviest concentration of automobiles anywhere else in the world. Now, Tokyo, Japan may be coming in, or London, England, or someplace, a fairly close second, but I think last time I heard it was something like 2-point-some-odd automobiles per person. More automobiles than people in the Los Angeles area, and when you get on an LA freeway, you can begin to believe it. Well, I so well remember, and perhaps nostalgically so, as Americans tend to, some of the earlier model automobiles I owned and drove, or didn't own and drive, if they belonged to my brother or somebody else. I remember the old 34 Ford we owned together that we paid about $125 for way back in the mid-40s during the war days. And when all the high school kids drove 1936 Fords and 35 Plymouths and 34 Chevys and the like, and when you had the old iron rims with the bolts on them that you so well remember, when you had a flat in those days, you had to patch the tube and take out the pump and fill it back up. You know, even just a little bit before that, automobiles were a fairly complicated little thing to run down the street. I so well remember a time in the front yard of my uncle's farm up in a tiny nook and cranny of Oregon. It was a bright, shiny morning. It had just rained earlier. That's pretty typical of Oregon, but now the sun was out. Everything was pretty much wet in the front yard. There were the glistening hydrangea bushes there. The Model A was parked over under a cedar tree, and out in front was a brand new, beautiful hay wagon. that my uncle and my brother and I had worked on for quite a period of time. And then on a bracket on the hay wagon was this little emery wheel, and below it was a gasoline engine. And on the hay wagon there were lots of tools, and I could hear the hum of this little engine. My uncle was out there sharpening all these tools. Well, my brother jumped on this old homemade tractor, and I got on behind him. And it was kind of rusty. He'd been sitting out of doors all the time. And the rubber had long since gone off the clutch and a brake pedal, and they were kind of worn smooth, as they will be. Have you ever stepped on a brake pedal or a clutch real rusty when it was still wet with slick leather shoes on? Well, my brother, sort of a spindly little guy, and I was even a smaller little kid at the time, was going to get this tractor ready to go out and hitch up to this brand new hay wagon so we could go out and get some work done. And he jumped on the thing, and he advanced the spark and shoved in on the throttle. You know, that was on the steering post. You could regulate it that way. But his foot slipped off the clutch when it was in low gear, and the thing leapt into action and headed straight for the Model A. Well, he barely managed to jerk it back the other way, and being a little scrawny kid, he wasn't able to handle a wheel quite that heavily and with that kind of purpose. And so it rolled over some of my grandmother's hydrangea bushes and headed straight for the hay wagon. All we saw was splintering wood, a collapsing radiator. I piled off to the side. Tools went everywhere. The gasoline engine disappeared under the whirring wheel of the tractor, and my uncle's feet kind of disappeared into the distance over there because the throttle stuck. Well, you probably remember the time, if you're 40 or older, when you enjoyed four on the floor, they call it today, when you went through the gears with a clutch and a gear shift. But the first thing they decided was too much work for the American public was going through the motion of changing gears with a lever in the automobile. Well, I guess before that, they decided it was too much work to reach up to the post, to the steering wheel, and to adjust timing or spark and throttle. And so they began to put in a throttle that you could pull on the dashboard, and it would stay locked in a certain position. A little later on, they went to a pedal on the floor. Well, finally, they decided to do away with all of that and just stick to the pedal on the floor and go to an automatic choke instead of one that you did by hand. Well, then they decided it was too much work to go through the gears, and so they went to an automatic kind of a system. It began with the fluid drives and the automatic transmissions of the 1946-47 model just after World War II. GM and Chrysler came along. Chrysler called it fluid drive. And it was too much work then a little later on to even have a clutch at all. So we took the clutch out and threw it away. And more ladies and elderly people and younger kids began to find driving simpler and simpler. And the cars got faster and faster and the engines bigger and bigger. And there was less and less to do. It was too much work to raise and lower the seats or to put them up and back. So now we have electrical seats. Or to crank open a window. That was too much work. Let's do it electrically. So we do that. Now it's getting to the point to where even the mirror, it's too much trouble, you know, to adjust it outside, so we do it to the button inside. That used to be manual, even though you did it inside without having to roll down the window, even then electrically. So now we're even coming up with little motors to drive the mirrors electrically, so we don't even have to go to the work to do that. So we have these automobiles of today, paper-thin metal, two-year built-in obsolescence, everything in the wrong place, nothing that seems to fit, 25 obviously easily discernible factory defects at time of delivery, so the individual gets a kind of a half-finished car and has to take it back to the dealer time and again on a warranty to try to get it put together because they left so many parts out of it when it was delivered at the dealer's place where you went to pick it up. And it makes me think, it makes me wonder. I saw on a TV show not long ago people gasping with great glee and amazement when they rolled back the curtain, and there was one of the most beautiful antique automobiles you ever saw. I don't know what it was, a Huckmobile, an Essex, an Overlander, or what. But here was one of these antique cars. You know, they're antique car clubs. You've heard of Harrah's Antique Automobile Collection in Reno, no doubt, and you need about 2 days to see that. It's absolutely fantastic to go through and look at the way they used to build those automobiles. There was a glamour to it, but there was also solidity. There was also a tremendous durability. There was heavy gauge steel. There were engines and automobile frames that lasted 10, 15, 20, and 30 solid years, as testified by the fact that many of them are still running today. So here was this thing as a prize on a quiz show. And you should have seen the excitement and the glee, so it made me wonder, why in the world hasn't somebody in the automotive industry simply decided to go back and reproduce a 1936 Ford? I mean, with the same gauge steel in it. Maybe they could even go back and remember in 1938 they had a V8 engine that was only 60 horsepower, but it sure got a lot of gasoline mileage. And it took you along the road at 60 or 70, and that's as fast as you dare go, and too fast today anymore, actually. If you want to really go along with what the president said and obey some laws that are even now being speculated about, if not put into effect by the time you hear this. Well, I don't know why Detroit didn't do it. It took the Germans to come over here with a Volkswagen to get some of Detroit to turn around and decide they needed a compact model that would get better gasoline mileage. In the meantime, there was an invasion of Subarus and Toyotas and all the other manufacturers' names that were coming from Western Europe, Germany, and from Japan. And so all our companies did was try to catch up, try to keep pace, because we're virtually being invaded with a kind of a practical piece of machinery from abroad that would last year after year after year. And even the idea that the styles don't necessarily need to change should have proved something to the American automobile manufacturers. The little Beetle, the little Volkswagen, has virtually remained identical in its profile from the very first one delivered to the United States to the last one, and yet they have sold like hotcakes. But Detroit never got the message. They've got to change the way they bend the tin around, get huge, useless, big, snorting, gas-gulping engines that don't really go anywhere, power you don't need, and a power-to-weight ratio that doesn't make sense. No adjustable spark or timing. No adjustable mixture or fuel flow, leaning it out or enriching it depending upon altitude or speeds in cruise. And then we affix these artificial so-called smog-removing devices, which increases the fuel consumption by up towards double in some cases that I personally know about, and we think we are polluting less and enjoying it more, and then we turn around and wonder, with our 2-point-some-odd cars per family, what in the world are they talking about? Not enough gasoline to go around.
Their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. When? When will the dreams of man become reality? The whole message of Jesus Christ is about a soon coming world government that will bring peace to our troubled world. For a full understanding of this message of hope about the kingdom of God, request, Just What Do You Mean, Kingdom of God? Write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.
Over 2 decades ago, we could have averted a great lion's share of the fuel crisis, at least when it concerns gasoline, simply by sensible, wise decisions made in the automotive industry or made under the force and the pressure of mere public opinion. But that would have gone contrary to the play ethic of America, contrary to the freedom of choice, contrary to the entire American way of doing things and the lifestyle that we have all become so accustomed to and so seem to enjoy. We could have made them smaller. We could have kept them slower. We could have kept the romance in driving, so to speak. We could have avoided 2-year built-in obsolescence and had automobiles that will run smoothly with little repair for 5, 8, 10, and more years. Automobiles handed down in the family to the third generation could have been a reality. But now they're handed down in 2 years to the dealer, and in 4 to 5, crushed about yay flat and hauled off to the garbage dump someplace, or hopefully to be recycled. We could also have taken a look at our practices of home building, of high-rise apartments, of cracker-box condominiums, of cheap, shoddy construction. We could have taken a look at the sprawling suburbia of the United States' big cities and of the haunted houses, the glaring, empty, brownstone apartments deserted in some of the inner urban areas where the racial crises and the ghettos are growing, and where the white people, the more affluent, tend to flee to the suburbs and leave the inner city to people of lower or virtually no income who do not have the tax base to support the urgently needed programs to clean up these cities in urban renewal programs, and so the cities fester and grow worse and worse. It was Mayor Stokes of Cleveland recently who was talking about this very cycle that is happening inside cities, that it isn't the mayor's fault when he's elected and comes into a city and leaves it in disaster, that there are forces that are in motion beyond a mayor's power to correct, which are simply not going to be headed off until the entire American point of view changes. Our whole approach to life changes to where we actually attack the problems and get rid of them instead of simply flee them or pretend that they are not there and ignore them. We could have built our homes differently, but we didn't. We could have built insulated homes, homes out of materials that are found in local areas that are actually sensible in terms of the kind of weather you expect. But no, we build cheap little cracker box uninsulated homes, and part of the home is expected to be washers, dryers, heaters, hot water heaters, refrigerators, ranges, usually always powered by electricity, sometimes by gas and the like. And this is a part of the home. When you go into a new home, you expect that all those energy slaves are there. Electricity throughout, maybe even the bathroom heated by electricity, the overhead heat lamps that are so popular these days. And so interruption in electrical service virtually makes our homes uninhabitable, because the BTUs put up by a few human bodies isn't going to keep a home warm that is built on the idea that it must have heating, or in a hot summer, that it must have artificial cooling. And so people during a hot summer, especially in big cities, find that the energy demands by the use of millions of refrigerator units and air conditioning units in office buildings and private homes cause such a drain of energy that it causes brownouts and blackouts. And as we heard in the one sensational New York City blackout of some years ago, on the whole grid system there of the New England area, they had to shunt so many millions of kilowatt hours or whatever down to the New York City area that it caused the tripping of some of these other areas. The energy discontinued, and it was a domino type effect. And the first thing you know, there was a big blackout all over the area, which included even interruption of service to people inside an iron lung, in an elevator, a subway running on electricity deep underneath the streets of New York City, people trapped and having to walk out in inky blackness like moles reveling in the bowels of the earth. So our big cities become increasingly vulnerable because that's the way we do things. We've been in the midst of a play ethic, not a work ethic. We've built our homes on the good ground and wondered why the desert doesn't grow with fertility to provide us all the things we need. Some of the best soil in the world is in the Los Angeles area, but all of that is under homes and asphalt. So we go out and farm the Coachella Desert, called a valley. If we had built homes with good insulation, out of heavy material, well insulated, out of brick and stone and mortar and adobe, in a sensible fashion, if the homes had been built out of quality materials and built to last, then we wouldn't have anywhere near the energy demands in many of the cracker box, cheap, single-walled, walk-up apartments and condominiums of this modern day of ours. But our entire way of doing things is now coming crushing in on us. Well, next time, I'm not going to have time to go further this time, I want to talk about human nature in the midst of the energy crisis, how it reacts. And I want to talk about hoarding and home freezers and wood stoves and what people are doing in the face of an energy crisis as opposed to what they should do. In the meantime, you ought to write for the Plain Truth magazine. This may not be the cover you'll receive. You've seen some of the other ones, and also the booklets you've seen announced on this program. I'll talk about this same subject next time. Until then, Garner, Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner, Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.